Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
From the moment the Pilgrims planted their feet on solid ground, drinking has played a role in American history. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. The amount we collectively put away has varied over time, and we have certainly vacillated between extolling the delights of alcohol and warning about its dangers. We Americans are known the world over for our lack of inhibition and sunny confidence. No surprise that many of us had sought to enhance those characteristics with a drink from time to time. Of course, we also know how badly things can go awry for those who drink to excess, and these sorrows have also been part of our history from the beginning. Author Susan Cheever explores the swings in our ideas about alcohol over time and how they have played into the story of the United States in her new book, Drinking in America, Our Secret History. Susan, welcome to Think.
Oh, it's a thrill to be here.
It's fascinating to me that one constant in American history is our inconsistent attitude toward drinking.
Well, that's one of the interesting things when I started pursuing this research, is that I found other countries drink more than we do, and some other countries drink less than we do, but no other country was the drunkest country in the world in 1830 and then outlawed it by 1930. We get the prize for ambivalence. We have a passionate ambivalence about alcohol. And, you know, another way to put it is the way the Puritans put it. They throughout American history, people have loved drinking and hated drunkenness, almost as if those two things have no connection. And of course, they do have a very intimate connection.
You open the book with a provocative statement. The Pilgrims ended up in Massachusetts because they were running out of beer.
Well, it's true. I mean, it may or may not be provocative, but it's what William Bradford wrote. It's what's in Mort's Relation. It's very clear that their anxiety about running out of beer was one of the main factors that caused them to land on Cape Cod. They were supposed to go to Virginia. Their charter was for Virginia, and they knew they needed to sail south. Their landfall was on Cape Cod. They'd had a very difficult journey. They were very glad to see land. But they couldn't get south. They gave it one stab. They gave up. And Captain Jones was also worried that he wouldn't have enough beer for the voyage back to England, which, as it turned out, he didn't get to take until the next spring. But, of course, also in those days, people didn't drink water. The water wasn't safe. There were no sewage systems. So instead of drinking water, they drank beer. Thirst, you know, caused you to drink beer. So beer wasn't just a means of getting high. Beer was also the only thing they drank, the way we drink water. As I wrote, you know, beer was their water, and beer was also their beer, of course. If you're drinking beer the way you drink water, it does have effects on you.
And this is men, women, and children. Did they have strategies for keeping themselves from getting a little foggy toward, you know, the latter part of the day?
Well, I don't think they noticed the effect of the beer. Of course, one of their strategies was to have no electricity. So
you could pass out at 5:30 when it got dark.
Well, you know, after dark, things take on a very different complexion. You go to sleep. But it wasn't just the Pilgrims. In the 1830s, the drinking in this country was phenomenal. School children had a drink before they went to school. It was called Flip, and it was grain alcohol and fruit juice, which certainly I would have liked school a lot better if I could have had a drink with my Cheerios or whatever, my Wheaties. So, and, you know, farmers, we were an agricultural nation then, had a bottle or a jug at the end of every row. So when they were plowing at the end of every row, they'd have a pull. Hmm. Factory workers broke three or four times during the day for drinks. So, you know, it wasn't just the Pilgrims. There are times when we have been an extremely drunken nation. And then times, of course, when we have made drinking against the law.
We forget that the Pilgrims and the Puritans were actually different people. Despite their reputation, the Puritans came very well provisioned to start up a brewing industry on this side of the Atlantic.
Yes. The Pilgrims were really, as my father used to say, the trash came on the Mayflower. The Pilgrims were really an odd bunch of people cobbled together. You know, the kernel of the Pilgrims was a group of separatists from Holland, English separatists from Holland. But in order to finance the voyage, they had to pick up all kinds of different people. And so it was a group, it wasn't a very homogenous group of people. It wasn't a wealthy group of people. It wasn't a group of people with tremendous resources. The Pilgrim, and of course, partly as a result of this, they landed at Plymouth Harbor, which is a not very good harbor, halfway between two of the greatest harbors in the world, New York and Boston. So that wasn't the best thing they could have done either. The Puritans, by the time the Puritans came, even though it was only 10 years later, everything was all mapped out. They were going to Boston Harbor. They knew all about it. They came in a fleet of ships, the Winthrop fleet. They brought their governors. They, you know, they brought everything they could possibly need, including the library for the Plymouth Bay Colony. It was a completely different kind of voyage.
It didn't take long for profit-minded colonists to fire up the insidious triangle trade, and this was molasses, rum, and enslaved Africans.
Right. It didn't take long. And I'm still amazed at how, well, particularly in a place like, say, Providence, Rhode Island, how quickly that's been sort of forgotten and what an effort it seems to be to remember the triangle trade. But many of the New England, many of the wealthy New England ship owners were involved in slaving.
You know, the introduction of alcohol isn't often listed among the horrible things that European settlers did to Native Americans, either intentionally or unintentionally. But the effects over time have been pretty devastating.
That's true, although that is a very controversial subject, as you well know, which is why you brought it up, Chris.
that is my job.
Know, in the old history, I mean, I'm trying to write a new kind of history, a history where we actually experience what daily life was like. I find that a great deal of history that gets written in the 21st century leaves out all the things I'm interested in. Food, clothes, sex, drinking. Those are the things, you know, reading maybe, that interests me. And those are not the things that I find in a lot of the history I read. There are certainly exceptions, Michael Pollan, Nathaniel Philbrick. I mean, we do have wonderful historians who do include what daily life was like. But very, very often it gets left out. And so in writing this new kind of history, I don't want to fall into any of the old traps. And I think one of those traps is to write inaccurately about Native Americans. And it's very hard to figure out, or I had a very difficult time figuring out, what exactly the role of European or British or even New England alcohol had in what happened to the Native Americans in our country. So I got to that subject and I just said whatever I knew, which wasn't very much.
What is it, when you're doing history and you're looking into the lives of people who didn't necessarily leave written accounts of earlier times in their own history, and therefore you have to rely on outsiders coming in, what do you do with those accounts and how do you sift through what you can trust and what might have been colored by sort of ignorance or unfamiliarity?
Well, I think this is going to sound very pedantic, but when I'm writing history and I get to something I don't know or something that I just heard about, you know, like the drowning of Dorothy Bradford, you know, a couple of people wrote about it, including her husband. But we don't really know what happened. We weren't there. She didn't write about it. I try to tell the reader what I know and don't know. In other words, as a reader, I want to know who's writing. I want to know where they're getting their material. I want to know who they are, and so that I can, you know, correct for their biases as a reader. And I want to know what they don't know as well as what they know. So as a writer, I try to accommodate the reader who would be me, if that makes sense. And when I get to something that I don't know, or when I get to something that I only know from possibly spurious accounts by other people, I try to say so.
Tell us about Dorothy Bradford. Another thing that history tends to leave out is the lives of women. And it does seem that our collective imagination about alcohol is that women weren't really free to drink very much until like the 20th century. And that's clearly not true.
No, it's not true. One of the interesting things is that, well, we'll go back to Dorothy Bradford, is that one of the reasons Prohibition was passed is that it was thought to be a very, very good thing for women. It was passed really almost instead of women's suffrage. The twining around of the temperance movement and the women's suffrage movement is very, very fascinating. Many of the women who ended up being suffragettes, Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, started out as temperance speakers, and they went around speaking, you know, against drinking, and were told they couldn't speak to audiences of men, and they slowly came to see that the real issue was women's rights, not drinking. But that conflation of women's rights and prohibiting drinking persisted, and everybody thought that women didn't drink, which of course is not true, and everybody thought that outlawing drinking would bring men into line in some strange way, would make it so that there was no longer the sad wife with the three little children waiting for the father to come home from the bar. Of course, women drank all along, just the way children did. They just didn't drink in taverns in the same way.
All right, and to Dorothy Bradford?
Well, Dorothy Bradford, you know, the first winter that the Pilgrims spent on Cape Cod was so terrible. I mean, it's hard even to imagine. Half of them died. There were 100 of them in November. There were 50 in the spring. And one of those deaths was Dorothy Bradford, who jumped or fell off the Mayflower into the water and drowned. And, you know, women in those days wore a huge amount of clothing, so that may have been a factor. And, you know, different things were said about Dorothy Bradford, that one of the men had threatened her, that, you know, that she had left a child behind in Holland, that was eating at her. But nobody really knows. I mean, it's a good example of where I think it's good for the historian to let the reader know that we don't know. We don't. Dorothy Bradford did not leave a note. We don't know whether it was accident or suicide, and we don't know what the causes really were. But it was such a sad thing. And part of that terrible, terrible winter that Bradford calls the starving time, because they didn't have enough to eat, and of course they couldn't drink water, and of course they didn't eat fish. I mean, they were surrounded by abundance in a way that we can hardly imagine today. But their preconceptions about what was edible and what was drinkable kept them from partaking of that abundance and caused 50 of them to die.
It's amazing to think about having the courage to leave everything you have ever known and yet not quite having the ability to open yourself up to different sources of, you know, food.
It is amazing. I mean, the Pilgrims are amazing, in many ways far more amazing than the Puritans, who, after all, had many more resources. But the Pilgrims really, first they went to Holland, and then they decided they needed more freedom, and they embarked on this really mad journey, you know, to an unknown land where they hoped to be able to worship as they pleased and live as they pleased. And of course, it was one of the most difficult voyages in history.
Author Susan Cheever is my guest. Her new book is called Drinking in America, Our Secret History. You can be part of this conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with test preparation courses for graduate school admission, including the GRE, GMAT, and LSAT. smu.edu/test-prep.
You don't know how to drink, your whole generation. You drink for the wrong reasons. My generation, we drink because it's good. Because it feels better than unbuttoning your collar. Because we deserve it. We drink because it's what men do.
That was a clip from Mad Men Season 1. You heard the character of Roger Sterling talking to the character of Don Draper. We're speaking this hour with author Susan Cheever. Her new book is called Drinking in America, Our Secret History. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. One thing, Susan, that really struck me reading this book was that George Washington, as a commander, realized there was a value to getting his soldiers, and I quote here, a little bit drunk before fighting a battle. Booze couldn't have helped their aim, but it must have given them some artificial courage when, honestly, the odds were really stacked against them.
Well, I think even when the odds are stacked for you, he said moderately drunk was the way he put it. If you're a little bit drunk, it's much easier to kill people, and it's much easier to put aside your own fear of being killed. That's why we call it Dutch courage, right? That liquor gives you a certain kind of courage. And the history of our great warriors in this country, and we've had many, is in many ways a history of drinking. Ulysses S. Grant being the best example of a man who was just a brilliant, brilliant general and who was often drunk. And part of Grant's brilliance, part of his brilliance was strategy, but part of it was just an inability to ever give up, an unwillingness to ever give up, a willingness to push forward no matter what the cost in lives or anything else. And really, that's how we won the Civil War. I mean, when Lincoln fired his sober general and hired General Grant, who had already been in terrible trouble and kicked out of the army for drinking. In other words, it was no secret that Grant was a drinker at that point. And Lincoln hired Grant, and the war began to change direction. In spite of the fact that Grant, you know, at Shiloh was missing on day one, nobody really knew where he was. His men thought maybe he had been drunk. Horace Greeley thought maybe he had been drunk. But as Lincoln said, he's a man who gets. And when people would complain to Lincoln, I just love Lincoln. Lincoln is, in this history of drinking, Lincoln is really the hero, a man who doesn't drink but doesn't judge. When people come to Lincoln and complain to him about Grant's drinking, he says to them, oh, yeah, Grant's drinking. He says, bring me some barrels of what he's drinking so I can give it to all my generals.
It is hard to fathom someone like Grant commanding the Union Army in this time of just extraordinary crisis with a horrific alcohol problem at the same time. I really can't imagine how he got it done.
Well, I think he had a horrific alcohol problem, but he was able to drink and lead at the same time. I don't think that's so rare today.
I want to talk a little bit about drinking in families, because this is a theme throughout the book. And first off, you give us the story of John Adams' sons and grandsons. Neither John nor Abigail Adams were dependent on alcohol, but boy, drinking took a horrible toll on their family.
Oh, it's the saddest story. And it's one of those stories where I had known all the little parts, but I had never really put them together. Hmm. Two of John Adams' sons died of alcoholism. Now, you know, we're talking about the early 19th century, so of course they didn't call it alcoholism, although they knew it was caused by drinking. But John Adams' adored son, Charles, looked as if he was going to be okay. You know, he went to New York and got married and had a couple of children. But by the time he was 30, he had drunk away his marriage, his career, his possessions. Even his sister didn't want to take him in anymore. And he died at the age of 30. And then his brother Thomas, it took a little longer, but almost the same thing happened. So if you look at John Quincy Adams, two of his brothers and two of his sons died of alcoholism when they were young, or in one case, an alcoholic accident. And that has a huge effect on people. Both John Adams and John Quincy Adams were our presidents, and these men were reeling from the tragedies that they had sustained from drinking, what one of the Adamses called the curse of intemperance. And, you know, Emerson said that John Quincy Adams acted as if he drank sulfuric acid for breakfast. Well, of course he did. Do you know? Hmm. I mean, sustaining losses like that will really make you an unhappy person.
Your father was the writer John Cheever, who didn't get sober, I gather, until long after you were grown. How does his drinking play into your memories of him as a father?
Well, it certainly plays into my memories of him as a father. How it connects to American history, I'm not so sure about, although certainly Mad Men is based on his stories, as Matt Weiner has often said. So we're doing a 360 here. If you want to know what my childhood was like, just watch those first seasons of Mad Men. And there are many similarities, although, of course, my father was writing fiction, and, of course, Mad Men is fiction on top of fiction. I think growing up with an alcoholic and an alcoholic family, you know, has different effects on everybody. One of the things about alcoholism that makes it so difficult to pin down is that it's different for everybody. Some people can drink a great deal and it doesn't affect them very much. Some people, like Richard Nixon, when we get to him, two drinks and he's gone. It really is, every alcoholic is different from every other alcoholic. And it's the same with families. You know, some family members in an alcoholic family become like John Quincy Adams, very angry and embittered and as if they had drunk sulfuric acid for breakfast. Other non-alcoholics in alcoholic families become control freaks, you know, hoping to avoid the destiny that they see coming their way. A very interesting example of this is Donald Trump, who is the non-alcoholic in an alcoholic family. His brother Fred died of alcoholism at 42, his beloved older brother Fred. So Donald Trump has many of these characteristics of the non-alcoholic in an alcoholic family, this desire to control one's destiny, this feeling that because one doesn't drink, one can control one's destiny. But again, it shakes out differently in every family. And I think, you know, my father's alcoholism was certainly had its unpleasant aspects, and it certainly genetically affected all of us, but it also, and it certainly, I do not think it improved his writing. That's actually my favorite part of the book, is where I look very hard at the idea that in order to write well, you have to drink, and I notice that it's just not true. I hope we'll get to that. But, you know, if you grow up in an alcoholic family, sort of, it's like walking a tightrope. I mean, you're always trying to keep your balance, with the alcoholic being, you know, the person whipping the tightrope around.
Let's listen to what Ernest Hemingway had to say about the role of writing and drinking. Here he mentions a microcosm of Venice that he discovered in a place called Harry's Bar.
The book came to me in a sort of a haze in Harry's Bar in Venice. Harry's Bar is a small place, but it is, in effect, a microcosm of all of that great and beautiful city which has been so well described by those writers, Ruskin, Sinclair Lewis, Byron, and others.
That was Hemingway talking about writing across the river and into the trees sometime in the late 50s. Certainly, he bought into that idea that, you know, when he talks about, you know, this coming to him in a sort of haze, I would imagine he's speaking about an alcoholic haze.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what you come by in Harry's Bar. I think it's so great to hear his voice, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think that, you know, when I went to look at this idea that writing and drinking go together, which is certainly a very, very prevalent idea, I started reading, many, many books have been written about how writing and drinking go together. The Thirsty Muse by Tom Dardis, A Trip to Echo Springs by Olivia Lang. I started reading these books and I started noticing they all use the same five writers. And I thought, well, why is that? And then, of course, I've written quite a lot of American history, so it occurred to me that the men who wrote American literature, Melville, Hawthorne, Emerson, Thoreau, Emily Dickinson, let's even throw in some women, Margaret Fuller, Louisa May Alcott, those people didn't drink. They just didn't drink. It wasn't an issue for them. They did not drink. They didn't drink. So if you look at what we call American literature, Moby Dick, The Scarlet Letter, Little Women, you know, Emerson's essays, that stuff was written without even drinking being on the horizon. So that really took me aback. And then I thought about Hemingway and Fitzgerald and Lewis and O'Neill and my father and Raymond, you know, the writers that always get trotted out. And contemporary writers now don't drink. I mean, they're not teetotalers, but if you look at Donna Tartt and Jonathan Franzen and Michael Chabon and John Irving, they're not drinkers. So I saw that this whole drinking and writers idea was really restricted to two generations of writers, and it started during Prohibition, and I think Prohibition may have triggered it. It starts in about 1920, and it ends in about 1975, and the last few writers, Pete Dexter, my father, Raymond Carver, all got sober. So there's a little kind of in-between generation of writers who get sober, but it's not true. It's not true now, and it wasn't true when American literature was being written. It was these two generations that have kind of spawned this idea that in order to write, you have to drink. And of course, when I looked even more closely, and I feel very uncomfortable about criticizing these people who really did write like angels, I saw that those early Hemingway stories, they are incandescent. Every word is just shimmering on the page. And the later novels, I don't feel that way about the later novels. And it's the same with Fitzgerald. Gatsby is a perfect novel. You know, The Last Tycoon. So you can see that even within this small framework of the, you know, five of our Nobel laureates, literary laureates in the mid-20th century were alcoholics. So when you look at these five people and the, say, 15 people that were drinking and writing around them, even within their lifespans, the drinking doesn't look as if it was so helpful with writing. And certainly, in my father's case, he started out as a wonderful writer. He wrote beautiful, beautiful short stories. He wrote two wonderful novels. And then, you know, it got a little bit dissipated. And then he got sober. And then he wrote his best novel ever, Falconer, which was also his best-selling novel ever. And then he won the Pulitzer Prize. So if you just take his life, it looks as if drinking actually doesn't help you. It looks as if it feels as if it helps you, but in fact it holds you back. And, you know, his first memory of coming to New York, what he did was, he got kicked out of prep school, so he wrote a story called Expelled about getting kicked out of prep school and how wrong they were. And he brought it to New York and he sold it to Malcolm Cowley at the New Republic. So he was a very young man. He was 17. And he was invited to a fancy literary party. And it was, you know, whatever it was, 1926. And they said to him, you know, do you want the brown liquor from the bathtub that we've brewed up in the bathtub, or do you want the green liquor that we brewed up in the sink? And he chose brown, but this was so glamorous to him. You know, this was the literary life. And of course, the way the story goes, he got sick all over the literary luminaries. But, you know, that idea of prohibition, of liquor being illegal, of liquor being something you had to make yourself, I think was very, very seductive for him and perhaps for that whole generation.
So you think the idea was that writers are, you know, by nature transgressive, they're rule breakers, and there was something about breaking the rule of prohibition that allowed many people to associate the creativity of great writing with the act of drinking?
That's what I think. I mean, what I am sure of is that American writers didn't drink, you know, in any remarkable way, with the exception of Poe, but they didn't drink in any remarkable way until the First World War, and that they've now pretty much stopped drinking. So that I'm sure of. You know, the numbers are there. Why that happened, I'm not as sure of. But it seems to me likely that Prohibition had something to do with it, because Prohibition is what's going on right when it starts. And it seems to me likely that liquor being illegal in the speakeasy way that it was during Prohibition made it very attractive to writers.
Was there a time in your life when you associated writing with drinking?
That's a really good question. I think I associated everything with drinking. But I certainly thought that if I had a drink, I would write better. But let me say, that never actually happened. I mean, I had a drink. But, you know, as a writer, I certainly do this a lot. I look back and I try to figure out what were the circumstances when I did my best writing. And, of course, at the time you're doing it, you don't know, or I don't know, if my writing is going to be good or bad. But when I look back, I go, oh, that was great. That was great. And, you know, I associate it with different editors who seem to be able to bring out the best from me, with different subjects that seem to be able to bring out the best. But I don't really connect it to drinking.
My guest is author Susan Cheever. We're talking about her new book, Drinking in America, Our Secret History. If you'd like to take part in the conversation, you can email think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. We'll come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with test preparation courses for graduate school admission, including the GRE, GMAT, and LSAT. smu.edu/test prep.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with author Susan Cheever. Her new book is called Drinking in America, Our Secret History. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Let's talk about Richard Nixon, because he grew up in a Quaker family. There would not have been drinking. Do we even know how old he was when he had his first drink?
We don't, but we think it was in the Navy. So he was an adult. He didn't drink until he was an adult. And he never drank much, or actually, he may have come to drink a lot in those long afternoons with Bebe Rebozo. But for a long, long time, he controlled his drinking very well, and he didn't think of himself as a drunk. He would just have two drinks, but the trouble was two drinks really impaired him. Somebody wrote that he tried to start World War III at least three times. And what would happen, what famously happened, there was a hostage crisis. An airline carrier was hijacked and taken to the Damascus airport by two people who started making demands. And when Nixon heard about this, he was just started screaming, "Bomb them, bomb them, bomb the Damascus airport." And it was Kissinger's job to make sure that what Nixon yelled when he was drunk didn't happen. And it was Kissinger's job to cover for Nixon when Nixon was passed out and couldn't be woken up. And as anybody who's ever had to babysit an alcoholic knows, it's not a fun job. So it actually made me very sympathetic to Kissinger, having to sort of run interference between this man who was president of the United States and who, after a couple of drinks, would really start saying inadvisable things. I think the saddest part of the Nixon story is really the Ehrlichman story, where Nixon had decided Ehrlichman was a very effective lawyer, very successful, a man who really had everything he wanted professionally. And Nixon called him in and told Ehrlichman that he, Nixon, wanted to hire Ehrlichman. And Ehrlichman said no. He didn't want to work for a drunk. He said, I can't work for a drunk. And Nixon said, oh, don't worry about it. I've stopped drinking. Which, of course, wasn't true. Hmm. And in the end, of course, Nixon destroyed Ehrlichman. So that's a little moral tale about working for people who drink and say they don't.
You also have in the book the story of John Chapman, a.k.a. Johnny Appleseed. This is in, like,
that.
Every
yes.
third grade history textbook. Is like, this nice man with a pot on his head who liked fruit, and that is not who John Chapman was.
No, John Chapman was not bringing apples to the frontier. He was bringing Applejack to the frontier. And again, you know, about me wanting to know who's writing the history, this was discovered by the writer Michael Pollan. And he just noticed that you can't grow an edible apple from a seed, that this whole story is based on a fallacy. And so he did a little research, and he came to see that, as he writes, Johnny Appleseed was not the cheerful American fruit lover. He was the American Dionysius. He was bringing apples from which you could make applejack and apple cider, and that's what they really wanted on the frontier. So it's a very different story than the story we heard in third grade and the story we saw in a Disney movie.
1-800.
I mean,
please go ahead.
It brings up this question of the importance of understanding American history as it actually happened. And I think one of the reasons I wrote this book is that I really want to understand, and I hope to help other people understand, what actually happened in American history, what it was like to be there, what it was like to see Johnny Appleseed coming down the dirt road, and what you thought, what it was like to be John Quincy Adams or to deal with John Quincy Adams. In other words, how it felt, how the day went down. And I think that Johnny Appleseed is a very good example of how history can go wrong. I mean, for generations, people have been told that Johnny Appleseed was this one thing. And it's very obvious that he wasn't, that he was this other quite different thing. So I think accuracy is the wrong word, but I really crave for myself as a reader and a writer a kind of history that reflects the world as I know it.
Susan, why do you think, despite all evidence to the contrary, I think a lot of Americans don't think of this as a particularly hard-drinking country? You know, you look at Europe, you look at other parts of the world, and you think, oh, the Russians drink, the Irish drink. You don't, somehow that, we know it happens, we just don't really incorporate that into the fabric of our understanding of what American culture is.
Well, I think we go back and forth. As I said, we get the prize for ambivalence. I think at the moment, we're not a particularly hard-drinking country. And one of the reasons I wanted to write the book is that I think we're going toward, I mean, we certainly drink less than we did 30 years ago. Not only do the numbers say that, but culturally, it's not acceptable to be drunk anymore. You know, it even 20 years ago, it was a very different story. 20 years ago, the drinking age was lower. 20 years ago, drunk driving was never prosecuted. 20 years ago, people didn't really make the connection between drunk driving and traffic fatalities, believe it or not. So we're really going away from being a drinking country right now. And I'm very worried that somebody will get the bright idea to outlaw alcohol again. And I just wanted to make the point in this book that that doesn't work, that when it comes to addiction and addictive substances, legislation is really not a good idea.
1-800.
I just had a conversation. Sorry, interrupting you. I had a conversation yesterday with somebody who said, well, you know, they're going to make new cars that all have this, this blow capacity so that you can't start the car if your blood alcohol level is too high. And I said to him, think about that. You start the car. That's what the cup holder's for. You get in the car, you put your drink in the cup holder, you start the car, and you have your drink.
Hmm.
So, you know, even the legislative mindset doesn't really fit with people when they want to have a drink.
To be clear, in case people didn't fully understand, you're not suggesting this is the way to do it. You're just suggesting this is the way people would get around that technology.
Oh, exactly. I'm just suggesting those kinds of rules don't work.
All right, let's go to the phones now. We have Greg on the line in Dallas. Hey, Greg.
Hey. Yeah, I agree with everything that you guys are saying about the trends, but it's my experience when I've traveled abroad is that folks kind of expect you as an American to be able to drink, and they'll always throw in their favorite brand, you know, whatever it may be. And kind of look to the American to be the, oh, yeah, here's the, even in Germany, even in Italy, you know, they kind of look to you to be the big macho drinker. So I'd like to just throw that in. Thanks.
Thanks for your show. Any thoughts on that?
Well,
Susan?
I think there have been many, many years when we have been the big macho drinkers. I mean, there's a wonderful quote in the book from a Frenchman who traveled around the United States right after Audubon, and he says, you know, Americans drink when they meet, they drink when they part, they drink at christenings, they drink at funerals. So I think that Europeans have different opinions about American drinking, but there have been times when we have been an extremely drunken country, and I think those times were noticed by Europeans. And I also think Europeans think of Americans, this is a wild generalization, as big eaters, big drinkers. We have big cars. And I think drinking goes along with that.
As you might imagine, we in this part of Texas have a lot of interest in the Kennedy assassination. And you write about the controversial question over how much JFK's Secret Service agents had to drink the night before he was killed.
Yes, it's a very controversial question. But there's no question about the fact that seven of them were up until 3, 4, and 5 in the morning in a bar. That's in the Warren Commission report. The only question is, how much did they have to drink? And how impaired were they at 12:30 the next day? And of course, those are sort of unanswerable questions. But I was shocked to find that, you know, two of the men who were in the follow-up car 10, 20 feet from the Kennedys when the first shot was fired had been out all night and had had something to drink. And just to take the weight off the drinking, I was also shocked to find the way they lived. They never had regular meals. The thing that had brought them to the bar in the first place the night before was that they hadn't had anything to eat all day. They were looking for something to eat. You know, they ended up with scotch and sodas, but they never got enough sleep. So these men were impaired for a lot of reasons. And, of course, Chief Justice Earl Warren in the Warren Commission report, and this is also in a wonderful book by Philip Sheenan about the Kennedy assassination, which I'm sure has come across your desk, he was furious when he found this out, and he screamed at the head of the Secret Service, do you mean to tell me, you know, these guys were out all night, that they wouldn't have been more alert if they'd gone home and gone to bed, that they might have seen the gun barrel? As I'm sure you know, some people saw the gun barrel. You know, so Warren himself was horrified by what he found when he found that some of these men had been out drinking.
Just to take this back to the origins of this country, I wasn't aware of how bowdlerized the story of Paul Revere's ride was and is.
It's pretty bowdlerized. It's such a great story. I don't know why why it is, but
I blame
Longfellow. Well, maybe Longfellow just ruined it for all of us, and I can never get that poem out of my head. On the 18th of April in 75, Hardly a Man Is Now Alive. The rhymes are so good. But yes, I mean, it's certainly true that Paul Revere was riding to Lexington to warn the colonists that the British were coming, but everything else is not what it is in the poem. Of course, the lanterns were set by Paul Revere, not for him to see. He was on a horse. He started before the British. He barely got across in front of their warship. And it was very much a kind of guerrilla operation. He muffled his oars with some obliging woman's underwear. They found him a lovely horse called Brown Beauty, and off he went, and he stopped at Isaac Hall's house for a couple of shots of drafts of rum and to keep his courage up. And there were two other riders as well. It wasn't just Paul Revere. And when he got to Lexington, of course, he wasn't yelling, "The British were coming, the British were coming," but he was there to warn them. So the whole militia turned out, and of course, the British hadn't even crossed the river yet. The British did not move fast. They had these ridiculous uniforms. Each uniform weighed 50 pounds. The boots fitted so badly, there were no left and right boots. So they marched in formation. The British hadn't even reached Charlestown yet when Paul Revere was saying, "The British are coming. The British are coming." And then there's this great thing where John Hancock was hiding in a house in Lexington. And part of Paul Revere's job was to get John Hancock out of there. So he goes to John Hancock and he says, "You've got to leave. You've got to leave." John Hancock is busy cooking dinner, which is a salmon, which he very much wants to eat. And Paul Revere is like, "Come on, come on, come on." So finally, John Hancock gets in the carriage and escapes, quote unquote, there's nobody there, to Woburn. And then he sends the carriage back for the salmon. I just love that detail. He's not going to give up his dinner. Anyway, Paul Revere, on his way out of Lexington, gets captured by the British. And he talks his way out of it, which, you know, maybe because he was a little drunk, he was so good at talking his way out of it. Maybe the rum had worn off. Maybe he was drinking all along. Then the militia, who had massed on Lexington Green, of course, had 3 hours to wait before the British actually showed up. And the place they chose to wait, or many of them chose to wait, was Buckman's Tavern, which is at the center of Lexington Green. So by the time the British got there at 5 in the morning, the militia were pretty well impaired. And the encounter between the British and the uptight, angry British and the drunken militia, I think, was a more fitting beginning of the Revolutionary War than what happened the next day at the Old North Bridge in Concord.
The new book by author Susan Cheever is called Drinking in America, Our Secret History. Susan, it's been fascinating. Thank you very much for making this time for us.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phone from Natalie Kalman-Kuhn. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.